We're on the record. All right. The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable J. A. Rustani presiding. For Consolidated Court Number 19-00178, Canadian Solar et al. Versus the United States et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiffs?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Sarah Witt from Maury & Grimson on behalf of plaintiff Canadian Solar et al.
Jordan Collins of the Walton Bloomfield Bureau on behalf of plaintiff intervener and consolidated plaintiff JUCO.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Justin Miller on behalf of the Department of Justice. And on the telephone is Paul Keith from the Department of Commerce this meeting.
Okay. Please be seated. Looks like we got enough plexiglass to protect everybody. Okay. Please, when you're talking to me at the podium, get your mask off, because I wouldn't know who you were except I have a piece of paper that says who you were. Let's see. I just want to check again, because I know Justin Miller's there. We have Paul Keith listening remotely. For the plaintiffs, we have Brian Chenko. Raise your hand. Sarah Weiss? Okay. If I mispronounced it when you come up here, pronounce it properly. Jordan Kahn. Okay. All right. All right. Who's going first?
May it please the court. Your Honor, again, Jordan Kahn, Grunfeld Desiderio, representing JUCO. I'm here to present the export buyer's credit argument that the court is very familiar with. We're challenging Commerce's decision to countervail the export buyer's credit program at 5.46% through application of adverse facts available. There's no gap in the record allowing Commerce to resort to facts available, let alone AFA.
Okay, well, why don't we just do it this way? I think I've already more or less said my opinion that you're not going to be successful if your only argument is the customer's certifications answer everything. However, I think you did a little more in this case. I think you said, what do you want besides that? That's basically, you said to Commerce, can we help, right? Or is it you or somebody else? Somebody put in their thing, put in their response that they were available to assist. Who did that?
Your Honor, Canadian Solar.
Canadian Solar. Mm-hmm. Okay. Somebody did. Okay.
That's right, Your Honor.
All right. So, I think you have to do more than put in just the customer receipts. If Commerce comes back and says we have verification issues, okay, they said we'll help. But they never came back to you and asked for anything else, correct?
That's right, Your Honor. There was no supplemental questionnaire issued on the buyer's credit. So we as JUCO and also the other mandatory respondent said that they didn't use it and they would know because of how the program operates, and they also submitted scores of customer declarations, and Commerce just said, well, that's it, AFA.
Let me see if I understand how this program works. This is essentially a favorable loan program, correct?
That's right.
All right. And the Export Import Bank disperses something to an importer's account, which is a separate count for EBCP, right? But, and that's a settlement bank account, correct?
Yes.
And somehow or another, nothing really gets out of China. What happens is somehow there's a credit to that account, and then there's a real credit to the exporter's account, right? Because the exporter gets the benefit. Am I correct?
No, the exporter is involved, and they have to get insurance and apply, but the funds are dispersed to the importer.
The funds are dispersed to the importer. Not really. So you think there's funds that actually go to an importer in the United States?
Yeah, that's the way that it works.
Hmm.
And what Commerce, in the second review.
I thought it's a loan, and isn't it actually not? It's not really money. It's a credit on the loan. There's a credit given on the loan, right? Isn't that how it works? There's no money that's leaving China. These are just a matter of credits. The importer owes the exporter something, and there's a credit somehow in one of these bank transactions. Okay, you're looking confused. Okay, why don't you just step aside for a minute? Who knows how this program actually works? Justin, you know? Come, let's talk about it. Come up here and tell me how you think the money flows in this wonderful... Then you can come back and make arguments. But I need to know how this works. Because I didn't ever see any money... This is all a matter of credits between the importers and the exporters. Isn't that what's going on? So you explain. How's the money flow? Or the credits flow?
I would direct the court's attention to page 31 of the decision memorandum.
Okay.
At the bottom, it seems to describe the nature of the flow.
Let me get
sure.
IND memo. IND memo, page...
31.
Okay.
And I don't believe that there's a firm understanding specifically how the program works, which is the reason why the Department of Commerce has been asking questions related to the specifics of the program. But
okay.
At the bottom of page 31,
okay.
It's Commerce's understanding that customers can...
Let me see what it says.
Sure.
Is it that last paragraph?
Yes, Your Honor. That has the three different
descriptions. Customers can open loan accounts for disbursement through this program with other banks. That is... They have a loan account in the settlement bank, and as I understand it, it's denominated as for, it's a separate account for EBCP. That's how I understood it. The funds are first sent from Exim to the importer's account. I don't see funds. There's some kind of credit to the importer's account. And then they're sent to the exporter's account. I think this is all a matter of credits.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the record's clear on that, which is the reason why the Department of Commerce issued these requests for information. There's two gaps in the record that Commerce has identified. One is this 2013 revisions to the program.
Yeah, but okay. I understand the $2 million floor just made it easier to have a smaller pool to look at.
Yes,
right?
Your Honor. It provided an easy way of confirming this information. But the other gap in the record is these names of these intermediary banks. And I think Commerce does a great job at page 33 of the record, 33 and 32. They've given an example using HSBC at the bottom of page 33 of what would be specifically required of Commerce if they were to attempt to verify non-use of this program. And they walk through and they say even if they would go to the customers or the respondents and let's say they knew that HSBC was a bank, one of these intermediary banks.
Why do you have to go to the customers? If the exporters are the ones who are going to get the benefit in the end, right?
Well, part of the issue is affiliation for the customers. So if the customers are affiliated with the respondents, I believe Commerce has a greater security that there will be compliance with the request. But if the customers are not affiliated, there's no guarantee that there will be cooperation in terms of asking for this information.
Okay. I understand a case where we don't make Commerce go do the work of going to third parties who they have no control over. But if you've got respondents who have some kind of relationship with customers, at least enough of a relationship to get them to fill out this form, then I don't see, it seems to me that's a little different.
Well,
you shouldn't be afraid of, oh, they're not going to answer because they don't have to. We've already got respondents being able to get things out of their customers.
The record of this proceeding shows a determination by Commerce that that was not enough. In fact, that they needed to go to the government of China in order to understand.
Where did the government say, respondents, this is the information we want from your customers. We want these books. We want all this. Where did they do that? I understand that all the government wants is China to answer. I said before, it's not enough for them just to say, here's the customer's response. And it's also just not enough for the government to say, we want China to answer, that's the end of it. The government is supposed to figure out what information they would want from respondents using their power to go to the customers to get the information that you need. You never asked them. You never told them. All you keep saying, all the government keeps saying is, we want a list of, well, in this case, dispersing banks, okay? I think later on they changed it to dispersing and settlement banks, right, to be more complete. In this case, they only say dispersing banks. And I think Judge Stansu said that's not a good enough question.
I believe on page 29 they call it partner and correspondent banks is the terminology that they use.
Partner and correspondent banks.
In this proceeding, on
where's
page
that?
29 and 32.
And is that in the questionnaire? No. That's not what you put in the questionnaire to the, that's not what you put in the questionnaire to the respondents. I know that language. I will
well,
find
specifically, I'm looking at page 29, the it begins with the paragraph beginning with first. About halfway through it, it describes what Commerce requested. Commerce requested information regarding the 2013 revisions.
Yeah,
and
but that's, not,
to the
that's not the language. That's not the language. Okay. Let me see if I find it. Let's see.
So actually at public record 150 at page 2,
let me find the stuff in mine. Is that...
Sure. So I'm specifically looking at the December 12th, 2018.
I need a supplemental questionnaire. No, you didn't send a supplemental questionnaire?
Correct. PR 150.
Okay. Sarah? Which one of these things is it? You can come around this way. I think, is it... This is the important record documents. It's a separate file. It's a separate file. Never mind.
156 is the actual response. Well, let me see what... Actually, no, 150 is the document I'm looking at.
No, we got one called E... We have one in important record documents called this. There it is. I got it. Matter of way to set up my files. Okay.
So at the first page of the attachment to PR 150 is what I'm looking at. And it's
okay,
question number two.
I got this. Okay. Provide a list of all the customers. I want the...
So question number two says provide a list of all
the
partners.
Question to GOC. Okay, let me look at that one. I got it. I'm looking for that question about, which is the question number about the dispersing banks?
The question I'm looking at describes it as partner and correspondent banks.
Okay. What's the number of the question in the supplemental request?
It's question number two.
Two. Okay.
of the first page of the attachment of PR 150.
Two. Mine says, provide a sample buyer's credit application along with the application's approval.
On page 6 of that PDF.
Page 6?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Provide a list of all partner correspondent banks involved in the disbursement of funds under this program. Is that the current version of the question?
I don't know, Your Honor, whether it's the current version. It's the version that was reflected in this proceeding.
Okay. Okay, let me see what that means to me. All partner correspondent banks involved in the disbursement. Is it involved in the disbursement? I suppose. Okay, so they asked the question in this case, everybody involved in the, and by partner or correspondent banks they mean?
I believe they mean these intermediary banks that are the importer's account that we're referring to, the importer customer account, where the money is initially dispersed to. But part of the confusion is that there's not a really well understood understanding of this, of the flow of this cash. That's the reason why they're asking the government of China for their information. The other part of the record that I would direct the court's attention to is the bottom of page 32. It goes to the point that you were making that customer certifications are not enough, because there Commerce describes how...
Well, I think they could be enough if Commerce was happy with them, but Commerce seems to want to verify them in some way.
Yes, Your Honor. Commerce needs to have a greater understanding of how these flows work, and all of this is driven back to the...
Well, if you ask them, wouldn't Commerce have a greater understanding of how this was working?
Well, Your Honor, in the prior segments of this order and in other cases, I mean, this is a perennial issue that we've all discussed many times.
And I've said, you guys get together, figure out what information you need, and I'm not thinking you're going back to China on this. I'm thinking that between importers' accounts at a settlement bank and exporters' accounts, that somehow or another you could get the answer.
Well, it's my understanding that in other proceedings, Commerce did engage in that colloquy with the respondents, and it was unfruitful, that based upon their exchange of information, there wasn't a path forward that would give Commerce...
Well, they never reported that to me.
Well, I don't believe it, because it never resulted in anything. We're in the fifth administrative review. In the third administrative review, when Your Honor provided those directives on remand, Commerce decided to find non-use. We never really got to that point. They basically capitulated. The record of this proceeding does mirror the record of the first remand results of the third administrative review. So in terms of comparing the various segments, you know, we're in the fifth round of this. So if you want to have a comparative analysis, this record is similar to the remand results, or the first remand results of the third administrative review.
Happened in that case?
Well, Your Honor did remand those results. So, you know, we recognize that.
So what's the state of that case?
It's finally resolved. On remand, Commerce found non-use, and Your Honor sustained that determination.
All right. So... Okay.
I mean, part of this is the government is trying to find a vehicle upon which either they're going to appeal the issue and have some resolution in terms of whether their application of AFA is in accordance with law, or they recognize that the current route is untenable. I mean, this issue's been before the court on numerous occasions.
Well, have they filed an appeal?
They have not, Your Honor. I mean, that's part of the analysis, is determining which proceeding is the most appropriate proceeding.
Well, just a second. You can't capitulate and say, oh... Let's wait for another case. How many cases does it have to go on?
Well, we're not capitulating, Your Honor. We are defending the determination in this proceeding, and Commerce goes on ad nauseum as to how it's impossible for them to verify non-use of the program based upon the current record and the gaps in the record that is necessary to.
You said there was no way forward. And I take it you asked the importers or the respondents who are exporter to get some kind of stuff, and they said no, we can't get that kind of stuff?
I don't know the specifics of the conversation. It was not in the context of this proceeding. It was giving a broader context to
why can't Commerce just say what it wants in order for it to be sure, other than China won't answer. Okay. What it wants. And if that can't be produced by the exporters, either working with the customers or directly because they have their own accounts, then if Commerce doesn't get what it needs and it's a reasonable request, then the court will say, well, China didn't answer and you couldn't give them the fill-in information, so indeed we have a gap, and then we go to AFA. I think what the court has never been sure of is that do we have a gap because Commerce isn't asking for anything. That's kind of where we are. And I think, you know, that's kind of been my thinking. Like, what does Commerce really need that would make it sure that this, that nobody's getting these funds or these credits or whatever, or this loan benefit, however you want to say it. But it just seemed to me that Commerce dug in its heels and say, China doesn't answer, that's all we're doing.
Well, for the purposes of this proceeding, Commerce has identified the two gaps in the record. It's the 2013 revisions and the names of these.
Okay, I'm not buying the $2 million. We don't have that floor anymore. Okay, it would make your life easier if we had that floor, fine. Mm-hmm. But that's not the answer. Your gap is you need to know the dispersing banks. Not a gap. That's a question they didn't answer. The question is, what's the gap that tells you they didn't use it? They say, hey, we didn't use it. Look at all this information. The only thing I see now is the issue is, can that be verified? That's not a gap. The information has been filled in. They have said, we did not use that program.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and so that's not a gap in the record. It may be something that's non-verifiable. And as a matter of fact, that's what Commerce has rested on before, that this is either non-verifiable or it's too onerous for us to verify it because of this other information. That's different than saying that there's no gap. They say we didn't use it.
Well,
that's not a gap. Your problem is you think because China didn't answer that question that there's a gap. There's no gap in this record. The gap has been filled. It may not be verifiable. The gap isn't filled. They say they didn't use it.
I certainly understand the court's frustration. I mean, this issue's been up on before the court on numerous
occasions. All I want is for you guys to come up with an outline, a reason of what you need in order to actually verify those certificates. And if you can't do it, you win.
Well,
if it can be done without enormous amount of effort, then you lose.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I see it.
Well, for purposes of this proceeding, I know that Your Honor disagrees, but the gap that they've identified in the ADM...
Yes, that's not a gap in this record. There is a gap. All you need to know is whether there is a countervailable subsidy. They answered that question. No, we didn't get it. And you say, I think you can say, well, we don't believe that. We want to verify it. So ask them for the documents.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, they have asked for the information that was related to the program to get a greater understanding of the program.
And I know they want... Commerce... Yes.
And part of the explanation in the IDM is that they would have a better understanding of what questions to ask the respondents if they had a better understanding of how the program works and how the money flows. If they had a better understanding of how the money flows, they would know specifically what information to ask for from respondents and their customers.
I'd sure like to know what these discussions were that didn't pan out and who was being uncooperative. I mean, if the respondents just can't get all this information, all these books and records from their customers, well, they can't get them, and that's the end of it. They lose. If they can get them...
Well, I know those conversations were not in the context of this proceeding. The reason why I raised it, because I've been before Your Honor on this issue a number of times, and in the third administrative review, Your Honor directed the parties to consult. And so as part of that, my greater understanding of the development of this issue across proceedings,
right.
I know they...
So let's go back to this, how this money is flowing here. Okay. This is to benefit buyers. Buyers are importers. Okay. There is some kind of loan made in order to buy the stuff. People borrow money. And there's some kind of credit given on this loan, right? Some kind of good rate. So, and that's the benefit. Do you understand it differently?
Well, I think that's part of the question here is, like, what are the specifics of the flow? I do know, as I put it on page 31, my best understanding of the flow is reflected on page 31, and I believe Commerce's best understanding of the flow was developed as part of the ISO-CORO administrative proceedings. I mean, this has been, happening in a number of CBD reviews.
Okay.
So on page 35, Commerce excerpts a quote from their proceedings that relate to their frustration in terms of understanding
okay.
the flow.
All the money comes from Ex-Im Bank. So apparently the customers can open loan accounts for disbursements through this program with other accounts. So they get a loan, and then the proceeds are dispersed to the buyer, to the exporter, the one who's selling the stuff, right?
I think there's a whole chain. My knowledge is limited to this paragraph on page 31 as to how the flows actually work, but that's part of the frustration.
Oh, I see. Your whole knowledge is this. You never talked to anybody at Commerce about what this means.
Well, no, I did ask questions, but when I ask these questions, they say that's been our frustration, is that we don't have a firm understanding of the flow of money.
Well, they seem to understand something. Customers can open loan accounts for disbursement through this program with other banks. The funds are first sent from China Ex-Im Bank to the importer's account. Well, I guess they mean there's a credit, which could be at the China Impact Bank or other banks. And these funds are then sent to the exporter's bank account. Okay.
So
it's just a matter of credits.
So I would also direct the court's attention to the top of page 30 of the decision memorandum. Commerce asked a series of questions regarding the method of transferring funds from the Ex-Im Bank to the Chinese exporters, and that bulleted list there are the questions that they asked. And the response they got from the Chinese government in response to those questions about the flows was, well, those are not relevant because we don't use them. They came back with the same response. So
okay.
I believe Commerce is asking the question.
All right. They haven't asked. What I see from all this is we have these certificates in the record. And Commerce says that's good enough because we can't verify it. That's what I seek out of Commerce, and that they need all this information to verify it. I just don't see a gap in the record. I see we didn't use the program. That's not a gap in the record, but you can come back and say we can't verify it. All right, let me get the other side up here. I only want to talk about this right now. Okay.
Understood, Your Honor.
All right.
Sarah Wiss.
How do you
Canadian
think this program Sarah. Works?
And my colleague, Mr. Khan, might come back up, but I did want to point, Your Honor, to page 28, first, of the decision memo. I think you might have already been there. But importantly, the government of China stated that the exporter itself is the entity that actually receives the money from the China Ex-Im Bank, and the Chinese exporter and the U.S. importer can verify usage. So when it comes to usage, again, there's no gap.
So by exporter, we mean the respondents here,
that's
correct?
Right. That's right. Both entities are involved, the exporter and the importer.
And okay. So what did the exporters do to show that they didn't use it? They said we didn't use it. What did they do to show? They come up with books and records to show that we didn't use it?
They looked at their books and records and reported that to the extent that they could. Now, we know that there would be evidence in their own books and records if they received it. So how can they prove a negative to the Department of Commerce? They reported, as the questionnaire requires, no, we did not receive this. They put on the record numerous statements from both unaffiliated and affiliated customers stating that they did not receive
okay.
it. And as Your Honor mentioned, this
okay, even if
for
the customers couldn't answer, something in the exporter's records is going to show that they got funds through this program.
That's right. And both the exporters and the importers that put declarations on the record say, we have reviewed our internal records and we can confirm that we did not receive any benefit under this program.
I think
and
what they would say is
verification.
The exporters' records are not necessarily going to show transactions that have some kind of label on them that says, this comes from the China Exim Bank.
Well, we can't get inside the head of the government of China here, but we can, in their certified submission, they've stated, when it comes to usage of the program, that the Chinese exporter and the U.S. importer can verify usage, would have record of the program. So that's all our client and their importers could do, is look at their own records, say, we didn't use it, we have no record of it.
So are any of these records on file in the record before me?
Well,
so I could see what a sample looks like?
Again, that's sort of a non-record because the Commerce has never explained and worked to say what else we could provide to prove a negative. They have not asked for the entire universe of loan agreements for every single unaffiliated customer's loans during 2016.
Well, they could ask for all the records of the respondents.
They could ask, but they have not asked for that.
And what would those, if they asked for those records, what would it show?
Well, that's going to depend. I mean, I can't speak off the top of my head to all of the different Canadian Solar affiliates' loan records during the period of review, 2016. But they've looked at the relevant places where their loan documents would be held and confirmed that there was no evidence of any benefit from this program. So there would be no documents to provide showing an export buyer's credit benefit in their system. So if Commerce wants to, do
and
a
are these
check,
systems would these systems be set up to show such a thing?
Yes, they absolutely would.
And how do you know that?
Because in order to certify non-use of this program, it's a certified submission under penalty of law that the respondent is saying, we have reviewed our documents and we have no knowledge of this. And the government of China, is worked in a CBD case, of course, has to collaborate. So they take their advice from the government saying that...
Let me ask you something. Every case I've had with EBCP, no U.S. company has ever had anything from this program. So if this program doesn't benefit anybody who buys and sells into the United States, then why is China keeping this program up for the United States? They could take the United States out of the program.
Yeah, Your Honor, of course, we're not counsel to the government of China, so we can't speak to their motivations, but we absolutely agree in our own independent research as well. We have never found a single instance where any respondent or their customers have reported that they use this program.
Okay. I'm not sure. Intermediate Settlement Bank. So you got a law. So suppose you got money through that bank. That still wouldn't tell you if it was from this program or not. I'm not sure that what Commerce is looking for out of China would give them any answers about usage of this program.
Yeah.
Do you have any knowledge of what the respondents suggested to Commerce, which might be a way to verify this?
Are you referring to in other cases?
In any case, this one or any that a suggestion to Commerce, ask us for this. This might be a way to verify this.
Well, I know in the third review, Your Honor, we were waiting for the respondent for the government to engage on this issue and collaborate on verification, and that did not happen. Let me just turn to my colleagues to see if there's...
Go talk to him quietly, and you can come back.
Thank you, Your Honor. In the third review, we did propose that Commerce could take a look at a sample U.S. customer's loan. We could provide a sample and reconcile that loan back to their total loans.
Well, that's not really the way it works. How would that help? Wouldn't it be that you tell them who all your customers are and they can go sample their records?
But we have told them who all of the customers are in all reviews.
And then, of course, you would have to make sure that those customers actually let Commerce go trot around their records because they're third parties.
So in this review, with respect, we haven't gotten to that point yet because Commerce asked no follow-up questions, and we put ourselves out there saying,
okay,
please allow us. We are open to verify. We'll do our best work with the unaffiliated customers.
Okay. Who else is here? Oh, I'm only on the Export Buyer's Credit Program. I haven't gotten past that.
Understood, Your Honor. I would just like to quickly draw the Court's attention to a supplemental authority that we filed last week, where Commerce, in fact, in a final determination rendered in March, did verify non-use declaration. So we submit...
How did they verify it? What did they do?
Well, we understand that it was a... this was in the small vertical engines investigation, and what they did was... because it was an investigation, there was a verification. I believe it was virtual. But what they did was, they checked, right, did the exporter receive money from an Ex-Im Bank, yes or no? Did the customer who was affiliated, did they receive money from Ex-Im Bank? If they had any loans during the investigation period, they would go through those loan documents to see if there's any reference to the government of China or this program. We don't think that this would be hidden. We submit that this can and should be verifiable. And not only have they done it recently, but they also did it in the chlorinated ISO Cyanorin investigation, where they had the customers involved. So they went to the U.S. customers and they went through their documents. And here we feel that Commerce could very well have done a spot check, picked a handful of customers, and gone through their records for references to the Ex-Im Bank or to other. The other loan documents. Commerce does this all the time, and we see this Court as having directed Commerce to come up with a modified verification procedure, and they keep ignoring this Court. They're capitulating under protest, but they're not appealing, and we think this is inappropriate.
Well, they couldn't really capitulate under protest because they hadn't done anything to get to that point. They have to get to a point where they comply with a court's order under protest, and then they can appeal. They decide not to comply with the court's direction. Well, that doesn't put them in a position to appeal. All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Come back. Okay. The way I see this, and I know this isn't how Commerce sees this, once you have a gap in a record, then that can be filled with adverse information. It's an inference. The inference is you were in a position to provide the information, you didn't provide it, and just like any ordinary civil case, when a person is in a position to come forward with information to benefit itself, then there's an inference that it wouldn't benefit it. But as with any other case, if somebody comes forward with information that totally rebuts that inference, adverse or not, it goes away. I don't see there being much in this case that a gap that needs to be filled by information that somebody has the duty to fill in, or it should logically be interpreted that information would be against them. It just seems to me there's no such gap in this record. This question that China didn't answer doesn't necessarily create a gap that we should interpret that information would be disadvantage everybody if China came forward with that information. This doesn't fit into that scenario. What we have is commerce would like this information and it doesn't get it, and then flip to the end, even though we have the rebutting information. I do see a different problem. Verification. Put aside all the evidentiary issues about inferences and adverse inferences and who rebuts what and who has. Commerce has a separate right, which is to verify. I see a verification issue. And we have a verification issue because commerce won't tell them what they need in order to get it verified. I seem to be back there. I seem to be back to this situation where commerce has to say what it could get, what it needs from every single customer or every respondent that would tell them. And if the answer is, we need to see that all your loans, every kind of loan, well, that's it. And if they don't want to give you that, well, then they lose. But I never saw commerce putting out any effort to get the information. What they want is this answer from China as a matter of principle. But I'm not concerned with principles here. I'm concerned about the facts of this record and whether there's gaps in this record. Right now, I see the gaps have been filled. I don't know if they're verifiable. And that's what I wish to focus on.
Well, Your Honor, on this question of verification and the conduct of the respondents, what I would direct the court's attention to is the bottom of page 32.
Okay, I'm ready to read again. Yep.
Well, it goes to your prior question to my colleague about, you know, what did Commerce do when they approached the respondents and how did the respondents show non-use? I mean, we all know that there's these declarations on the record that say non-use, but how did they show it? And here's where Commerce gets into their explanation that the respondents failed to do anything more than to come forward with these declarations. There wasn't, you can read there at the last paragraph there, that they failed to explain the steps they took to determine non-use of the program by their customers.
Okay, failed to, the steps they took, yes. And then I get, okay, all they did was they said, if you haven't used the program, give us a certification that you haven't used the program. They didn't ask for anything else. But you didn't ask them for anything. You didn't ask them to get anything else.
Well,
you didn't ask them to get anything. Commerce wants to stop with, if China doesn't, this is my view of commerce in these cases is not just this case, every case. China doesn't answer, we flip to the end of the road, and we have 400% duties, except in this case we only have 12%. But I don't think that's the way the statute works. I think the statute works, there's information missing. It can be filled in by neutral facts. It can be filled in by adverse facts. If, as I said, one would expect the person to come forward with beneficial information if they had it. Therefore, they don't come forward with beneficial information, and we presume that it's adverse to them. In this case, we have statements that they didn't use the program. And if Commerce wants to say we can't verify it, I guess Commerce has to say what it needs to verify it. That's where I've been, like, for the last couple of reviews. I mean, you know, this has evolved over time.
It has evolved, Your Honor.
Once upon a time, Commerce said, okay, these certifications of non-use are fine. And
I'll just leave as a parting remark. There's many, many pages of analysis in the decision memorandum regarding this.
Yeah, I
find
know.
That pages 32 and 33 are the most helpful.
Yeah.
So to the extent that the court goes back and looks at it further after our proceeding today, those two pages I find to be the most illustrative regarding their frustration.
They didn't answer my questions before, and I don't think they'll answer my questions if I read them again, but just let me take a look here. See, the problem with this is it doesn't seem to recognize that these accounts are separate accounts in that are only for the export-import bank program. And eventually, there has to be a credit back to the exporter. And somehow or another, I don't know that there's a recognition here that the correspondence between the importer and exporter should line up if there's one of these loans. Okay. I'll read it again, but I don't think it's going to give me any more answer than I've never had. So maybe we'll set it up so Commerce can do something under protest that it can then appeal. I don't know. All right. Other side, come back. Any other brilliant ideas? No, what do you want me to tell Commerce to do if I remand it?
I would direct them to, at this stage, given their unwillingness to conduct the verification, I would say, you know, direct them to eliminate the countervailing the buyer's credit.
Because they're unwilling to verify. Okay. I may do something different. I may require you to file a supplemental memorandum to me telling me how you think Commerce could go about verifying this. And then I'm going to ask Commerce to tell me why that doesn't work.
Okay, you're
right. I'm going to make you do on the record which I expected you to do in a reasonable discussion in a prior review. So I think that's what we'll do. I will issue an order on this. Why don't you give me an idea of how much time you would need to tell me what you think Commerce would need to verify this from your point of view?
We think 2 weeks, Your Honor, would be
a okay.
reasonable amount of time.
All right. I think that's what we're going to do with this. I think I will let you tell me what you think. Since I think there is a verification issue, maybe I'm wrong. I think there is one. I think that you should come up with how it could be verified, and then Commerce can say, no, that doesn't work, and then I'll decide what I'm going to order after that. So we're going to take another step in this case, see if we can get to a resolution. At the moment, I'm not happy with customer non-use answers all, nor am I happy with China didn't answer that question, so we flip to the end and have adverse facts. Neither of those, I think, is the right answer. I could be wrong.
Understood, Your Honor. We look forward to working.
All right, let's give it another go. All right. You want to say anything else, Mr. Miller?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. I'm going to let them tell me how they think this could be verified, and then Commerce gets to tell me why that won't work. Because as I recall, this IND memo was not very convincing to me on that point, that it couldn't work. All right. But maybe Commerce will say something else that convinces me. All right. Well, I guess I don't have a very open mind on CP, although it's open as to who wins. So, been down too far down this road before. Okay, what other issues have we got that you want to talk about today, other than EVA, which we'll do later? Okay, what do you want to talk about?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Again, Brian Senko on behalf of Canadian Solar. I will speak on behalf of the issue of creditworthiness and the land benchmark.
Okay.
I can go in either order if Your Honor has a preference.
Talk about it.
All right, I'll start with creditworthiness then. Commerce found that 5 Canadian Solar affiliates were uncreditworthy in 2016. The central question here is whether Commerce can ignore loans received by certain Canadian Solar affiliates that were not a part of the co-owned entity when making its creditworthiness determination.
Well, I don't get that exactly.
Sure.
Okay, you have affiliates and they get a loan.
Mm-hmm.
But how does that mean you can get a loan?
So, two answers. One substantive and one procedural.
Okay.
The first answer is, just for background, when Commerce is making this determination, it's based off of 19 CFR 351-505, and one of the things it's looking at is receipt of a commercial comparable loan as dispositive evidence of creditworthiness. Archer Daniels, a case by the Court of International Trade, looked at that and said, okay, what are we looking at? And they came up with the central standard is Commerce is putting itself in the place of a bank and asking, would a bank issue a loan? And here, Your Honor, the bank would issue a loan. A bank would generally look up the ladder to the creditworthiness of the overall parent corporation. And why it matters, why I can't just look at, so affiliation versus co-ownership is a Commerce standard. It's used to calculate a subsidy. A bank would be looking at something different. And the reason, a bank would be looking at the overall creditworthiness of the entity. So it needs to look at other affiliates outside of the co-entity.
But, okay, affiliates aren't, they may be affiliated in some way, but they're, the assets of an affiliate don't stand behind the assets of another affiliate. That's why they're talking about cross-owned, right?
Yes. But in this case, I actually printed it off because it's not in the joint appendix, but it's directly responsive to Your Honor's question. I'm happy to pass it along. It's from the Canadian Solar's creditworthiness questionnaire. And the reason why you look...
So what do you mean it's not in the record? It is in the record.
It is in the record.
Not in the appendix.
Not in the joint appendix. Correct.
Okay, just a second. Mr. Miller, do you have a... Do you care if I look at this thing? What's in the record?
Well,
I mean, but he needs to know what you're talking about.
I have no understanding
okay.
of what they're referring
to. All right.
It is in the record. It's before the court in the administrative record. It's just not in the joint appendix.
That's great. It's not in the joint appendix, so you make it impossible to find. Okay. Give me the cite to this thing.
Sure. It is... One moment. It's the... CR 259 through 85, and it's Exhibit 1, and this is Canadian Solar's creditworthiness questionnaire at Exhibit 1 at 44.
Okay. Sarah, did you get that down? Okay. Because
okay.
I will go say, Sarah, find that. So if she, is this a citation that will enable you to find something?
I'll do my best.
Okay. All right.
So we did submit portions of Canadian Solar's creditworthiness questionnaire. This
okay,
is
what
just
you,
responsive
okay, what
to
do you want to say about it?
Okay. So essentially, the reason that it matters looking at affiliates is in this case, it was in 2016, one of the co-owned entities, Canadian Solar Incorporated, through its wholly owned subsidiary, worked with an affiliate as part of a what they call a equity subscription agreement with the affiliate outside the co-owned entity. That affiliate gains a loan from a commercial long-term bank, and then Canadian Solar Incorporated, the co-owned entity, reported it in its 20-F form before the SEC, and here's why it's important. It found that this loan between its affiliate, it had the power to make decisions over the activities that most significantly impacted the project related to this loan, and therefore, it was the primary beneficiary of that loan. And therefore, essentially, if you're looking at a bank is going to look at who benefited. And to do that, it has to look at the co-owned entity. And if you're looking at the co-owned entity, you're going to be looking at overall creditworthiness. So that's the substantive portion. The second part is more procedural, Your Honor, in that Commerce never, in its issues and decision memo gave a very basic explanation of why this matters. It essentially said, and I quote, based on our past practice, we find that we cannot rely on these loans to demonstrate the creditworthiness of Canadian Solar as they were not issued to companies when they're in the cross-owned entity.
Okay. All right. So, Commerce also has information that I guess the cross-owned entities, the whole
correct
group of them, had insufficient flow, distressed current and quick ratio levels,
correct,
and insufficient liquid funds to cover their obligations. So why isn't it just a matter of weighing, and they had plenty of information on creditworthiness?
Because under the regulation itself, it says a loan is dispositive of creditworthiness.
It's dispositive? Loan to an affiliate is dispositive?
It doesn't specify. It just says loan in general. So it says the receipt by the firm of a comparable commercial long-term loan, this is 19 CFR 351-505, and then that's part one. And then part two says the significance of long-term commercial loans in the case of firms not owned by the government, the receipt by the firm of a comparable long-term commercial loan unaccompanied by a government-provided guarantee will normally constitute dispositive evidence that the firm is not creditworthy. So that's why loans are so important. And getting to what the procedural point I was talking about, why it matters that Commerce is now, it's a post hoc rationalization. So they're essentially now saying it matters whether it's a co-owned entity versus affiliate, but they never explain why it matters. They just are saying, essentially, it's important because you're looking at, they give an explanation, but it's a post hoc rationalization, which this court can't rely on. And there's plenty of case law to that regard, starting with the Burlington truck case.
You want to tell me anything else, or will it, I like to do this issue by issue. I'm just going to let Mr. Miller come up on
this
issue,
add,
and then you can go to your other issue.
I would just add, again, concluding that at a minimum, a remand is necessary to explain, since it's not in their IND memo, why co-owned entities and affiliation really matter here. It's a post hoc rationalization. And under Chevron, no deference is due. There's plenty of cases like Shisheng Machinery and
Yeah, we don't like post hoc rationalizations. He'll tell me why it's not.
Okay.
Okay, let's find out what he says.
Your Honor, if you saw the regulation book, I think that's best to start with the regulation itself.
Yeah, I got it right here.
So Canadian Solar relies most specifically on
351.505. Yeah. What do you want to tell me about it?
So A4, little I, the beginning portion of that regulation says, this talks about the loans that were just referenced, and it talks about receipt by the firm. So Commerce interprets the firm as the recipient of the alleged countervailable subsidy, and this is by regulation. So if we jump to 351.102B23, it's the definition of firm. So it's defining what the loan regulation is referring to.
So 102?
Yeah, 351.102.
B23. Firm.
It's defined as the recipient of an alleged countervailable subsidy. So this is the legal basis by which...
Including any individual company, partnership, corporation, joint venture, association, organization, or other entity.
So
that's just... But that doesn't tell you who the recipient is in terms of cross-owned or affiliated, does it?
Well, by defining firm as the recipient of the subsidy, Commerce is interpreting firm as has to be a cross-owned entity, that affiliation would not qualify as the recipient of the countervailable subsidy. So it's their interpretation of the word firm as being limited, as excluding affiliation, basically. I'm not saying it's going to be limited to cross-ownership. Here they're saying they focused on cross-ownership, and Canadian Solar agrees that the loans were not made to any co-owned Canadian cross-owned entity. But it all hinges around the interpretation.
And where did they say that recipient is only cross-owned and not affiliated? Was that in the IND memo?
Well, the only reference to this is on page 67 of the IDM memo, and it's referring to the third administrative review. So it's more of Commerce's practice as to their analysis of creditworthiness. Page 67 of the decision memorandum.
Okay. And it's where?
Well, it refers to the broader regulatory framework of the 505 Rome regulation that we're referring to. But in terms of rejecting Canadian Solar's arguments here, they were looking at the main regulation being cited by Canadian Solar, which is this A4II, talking about the recipient by the firm, and the firm has a regulatory definition.
This is one of these things where you want me to discern that that's what they were talking about when they cited to 504A41, that they meant recipient was cross-owned?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but it goes beyond the practice of the Fifth Administrative Review. The Commerce is citing the Third Administrative Review as well, so there's an established practice by which Commerce is analyzing creditworthiness. But in terms of the actual definition of firm, I mean, it's a regulatory definition in terms of...
Let me just ask you something. Okay. Okay. Assuming an affiliate loan to an affiliate is not dispositive, is it some evidence of creditworthiness to be considered?
Well,
Commerce didn't consider it at all, right?
So there are factors that Commerce can consider for creditworthiness. They're identified in the paragraph right prior to that, A4I. Mm-hmm. And Commerce has broad discretion in terms of which factors it wishes to consider. So the actual the factors are listed there.
So in 525, where are we?
So 505A.
Is that back in 505?
Yes. Okay. It's the paragraph directly above the dispositive evidence. A paragraph that Canadian Solar referenced earlier. So it's A4I.
Creditworthiness.
And I will note that the Archer Daniels Midland case that was referenced by Canadian Solar, there's analysis in there indicating that Commerce, quote, has flexibility and discretion in determining which factors to consider and weigh in making its creditworthiness determination. And you've identified elsewhere in the decision memorandum the other evidence on the record
right.
that Commerce considered for purposes of their decision to find these entities
uncreditworthy. Can I ask a question which relates how this works? Sometimes all these affiliated companies are collapsed into one company for AD, but you don't seem to do that for CBD, right?
I'm aware of the collapsing principle in the AD context. I don't know the relationship between the two. I do recall that collapsing is a very fact-intensive inquiry, but I don't want to guess in terms of providing some sort of representation of the relationship.
You know, I don't know. Maybe, you know, collapsing actually is used to, I think, decide kind of the universe of sales that's being considered. So it may not relate at all to this.
I mean, this issue boils down to discreetly to this legal question of, you know, the firm being interpreted as being exclusive of affiliates
okay.
and then the factors that Commerce can consider for creditworthiness.
Okay, well, why do you think that cross-owned, I have my own ideas, but why do you think cross-owned's important in determining firm as opposed to affiliated?
Well, it's because of this idea of like the recipient of the alleged countervailable subsidy. So if you're cross-owned, if as you noted, the control and the commingling of decisions as well as possibly assets, I don't know exactly. I mean, cross-owned is, by the way, defined in the statute. So if we look at 19 CFR, by the regulation, I'm sorry, 19 CFR 351.525, B66, cross-ownership between two or more corporations exists where one corporation can use or direct the individual assets of the other corporations in essentially the same way as it can use its own assets. So it goes to this idea of being one and the same.
Well, sometimes they decide, in AD cases, I'm thinking, Commerce sometimes decides that because there's control, they're to be collapsed even though they're only affiliated and not totally cross-owned. Anyway, there can be different rules for CBD
yes,
and AD.
Yeah, I was just going to know the differences that between AD and CBD proceedings.
Yeah, okay. Let him come back and he can explain to me what he thinks. I'm sorry saying he and not your name. I
no
apologize,
problem, Your Honor.
Mr. Tenko, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, 3 points, Your Honor. Again, even before we get into this debate of what co-ownership versus affiliate is, it's a post hoc rationalization, so it's not even really relevant, especially, it may be relevant on remands, but not here. And it's important, counsel for a defendant stated that it was a past practice, and stated it was past practice based on 3AR. But in 3AR, if you look at that decision memo, Commerce also doesn't explain why this matters. It doesn't explain why the difference between affiliation and co-ownership is important. Okay. Second point is affiliation versus co-ownership, getting past the post hoc rationalization, is a Commerce-specific inquiry. And getting to Your Honor's point, the reason when you're looking at CBD, essentially you have the broad variety of affiliates, and then you have co-owned, means you have control or ownership of other affiliates. And then only certain co-owned companies have to report a questionnaire response, essentially, if you're using an input, if you had a benefit. So all these three, they're essentially narrowing it down to get at the benefit and the subsidy. And the reason that matters is, while counsel is correct that they have broad discretion to look, that discretion is still looking at what a bank would do. Archer Daniels is clear that it's, would a bank issue the loan because the loan is dispositive? And here, because affiliation versus co-ownership is a commerce distinction, that's not what a bank would look at. A bank would look at, can this entity repay the loan? And here, as I explained, it turns out, in this case, the co-owned entity actually is closely related to this affiliate, so much so that it's reporting in its 20F that it considers itself the primary beneficiary of the loan. So, therefore, a bank would almost certainly look at the creditworthiness of Canadian Solar as a whole. That's, unless Your Honor has any other
no,
questions.
I think it's okay. All right. Thank you. You want to talk about the other issue now?
Sure. Land. Just one second. Okay. Your Honor, in short, this argument comes down to Commerce relying on a fatally flawed, outdated source to calculate its land benchmark. Commerce relied on a decade-old 2010 CBRE report to calculate its land benchmark, where Canadian Solar submitted a 2016 and 2017 CBRE report that provided contemporaneous data on the record. Commerce's rejection of Canadian Solar's source is unsupported by substantial evidence for two reasons. First, Commerce vastly overstates the difference between a world market price data submitted by Canadian Solar, a Tier 2 source, versus the data specifics of Thailand, a Tier 3 source, relied upon by Commerce, where both sources require Commerce to use pricing data outside of China, regardless of whether it's a Tier 3 or a Tier 2 or a Tier 3. Secondly, Commerce's source is fatally flawed by relying on outdated data requiring the use of a price inflator, which thereby causes inaccuracy in the calculation.
Okay, well, itself. They wanted Thailand, right? And Thailand's not in the 1617 book, right?
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Thailand isn't in the 1617.
Oh, yes, correct, Your Honor. It's not in Canadian Solar's data, correct?
Yeah.
But to that point, Your Honor, the issue is, you're looking at when Commerce selects a benchmark source, essentially, and they set this forth, they're looking at two things. They're looking at geographic proximity to China, and then they're also looking at economic comparability to
China. Is there anything wrong with looking at geographic proximity?
No, and that is, Commerce can look at geographic proximity, but, Your Honor, what Commerce can't do is it provides no explanation why it is basically elevating geographic proximity over contemporaneity. So it's providing no explanation in its IDM. It just states that geographic proximity matters because you're looking at whether a country is a viable market. So they're saying Thailand, because it's close to China, is a viable market and consumers would look there. But what they don't get into in this, then that why geographic proximity trumps non-contemporaneous data. And here, Commerce has repeatedly stated that contemporaneous data is its preference, especially in this case. It stated that it relied on the laminated woven sacks case that informed its analysis of this issue, and in that case, it relied on a 2007 data for 2006 POR, so 1 year difference, where we have a 6 year difference here. Secondly, Commerce determined on the issue of the merit data to value ocean freight for certain months where its calculation required the use of a price, it rejected its Maersk data where it was required to use a price inflator. And further, in other cases on land, Commerce has stated the importance of contemporaneous data, for example, in the polytetrafluoroethylene resin from India, and that is 82 Federal Regulations 223-422.
Ken, are you sticking to your position that they have to use a Tier 2 benchmark?
No, Your Honor. More that they're overstating the emphasis because, for example...
Wait. As I understand it,
mm-hmm.
Tier 2 is world prices.
Correct.
And for somebody, and it doesn't really fit with land, right?
That is Commerce's explanation. We would argue that...
And, I mean, it's more than that. It's world prices for somebody who could buy that product in
right.
the country we're talking about. And I can see how Tier 2 doesn't really fit with land. Commerce is not totally crazy on this point. I think it's more you're arguing, from what I'm hearing here, that their choice of Tier 3 wasn't good. We're essentially looking for, if I look at the AD context, something that's like a surrogate country.
Correct.
Right?
And I actually have a point towards that.
Okay, you want to say?
So you're essentially, yes, you're looking to a surrogate country. And even though our source is potentially a Tier 2, it could be treated as a Tier 3 in that you could pull out data. For example, it has specific data for Mexico and Brazil. So Commerce easily could have treated this Tier source, if it had an issue with the Tier 2 source, as a Tier 3 and used data for Mexico and Brazil. And getting to the AD
Yeah, source, but then, of course, they're not the geographic proximate country.
Correct, and I think our response to that is...
So your answer is the consumer price index fix for the old data just isn't good enough because...
Because it introduces inaccuracies into the calculation, which Commerce itself has noted, in this case itself, where it rejected Maersk data because of that.
All right.
And where you have Mexico and Brazil, which on the AD side are considered surrogate countries that are economically comparable to China, you could have used the data from Mexico and Brazil. Here, Commerce tries to argue that, well, the AD side really doesn't matter, it's a separate determination, but the factual determination, Your Honor, is still the same. On the AD side, when coming up with surrogate countries, they're looking at gross national income.
Right. Okay.
And they did the same thing here in Thailand in the land benchmark analysis memo, they're looking at GNI. So it's essentially the same thing, that you have countries that are economically comparable to China that are contemporaneous, and the only really factor is geographic proximity, which Commerce provides insufficient evidence to explain why that trumps everything else.
Okie dokie.
All right.
Thank you. Mr. Miller again.
Your Honor has correctly identified the legal framework upon which this question should be decided, which is Tier 3 benchmarks. Essentially, Canadian Solar is arguing for world market prices, which is a Tier 2 benchmark, but as Your Honor noted, Tier 2 is not appropriate.
Well, also, it's hard to say that that document is a world price. I mean, it's an amalgam of certain countries.
Well, and that goes to the reason why Commerce rejected it for purposes of Tier 3. So when we turned to the Tier 3 analysis, Commerce identified two specific factors they were going to look for in terms of finding a suitable surrogate benchmark. As you noted, it was geographic proximity and economic development comparability. Commerce did an extensive analysis of this question going back to the Sachs from China proceeding, and then they did their land benchmark analysis memorandum that goes to 30 pages of this analysis.
He's not really fighting you on the geographic proximity question. I think his big problem is it's such old data that the CPI really introduces inaccuracies. And let me ask you about CPI. It's not really for land. I mean, right? The consumer price index, it's based on, products, consumer goods, right?
Well, in this respect, I believe Commerce has a broad degree of discretion in terms of the factors that it considers and why data would be not suitable versus other data. Commerce did address this at page 59 of the decision memorandum, and it states there, while Canadian Solar included consumer price index data collected by the World Bank in its submission, its submission does not include data that allows us to evaluate these locations' economic comparability with respect to China. And the reason for this is the world market data would include data from other countries. So it's this conglomerate of data, and the record lacks the economic data for Commerce to conduct the analysis necessary to do this economic comparability, which is part of the reason why it rejected the world market prices. Here, I mean, at page 59, it went through both factors, both geographic proximity as well as economic comparability in terms of rejecting the world market prices submitted by Canadian Solar. On page 30 of the land benchmark analysis, it does get into an in-depth analysis as to why the two factors, geographic proximity and economic comparability, are important. So to the extent that the court looks at this issue subsequently, I would direct it to page 30. It has a wealth of information as to why those two factors are compelling.
Yeah, I don't think they're really fighting you on that.
Okay.
Okay. You want to say anything else? I understand you're not fighting him that they can't consider geographic proximity. You think that given the age of the data, they've overemphasized it.
Correct.
Is that your central argument?
Yes,
okay.
Exactly, Your Honor. And especially, as Your Honor hit, so CPI is a consumer price index. So you're looking at all consumer goods, not just land. So the more you use it, the further away you're getting from an actual land industrial price. And Commerce responds that how is it clear that land isn't essentially in pace with how are consumer goods not essentially in pace with land, that there's not evidence on the record. And our response to that is it goes against Commerce's own practice. They recognize that CPI introduces inaccuracy. For example, in the Changzhou China case, which is 255 Federal Supplement 3D 312, which is actually before Your Honor. This was related to the 2AR CBD review. You noted that Commerce explains its preference for contemporaneous data by stating that non-contemporaneous freight data may have been affected by factors not present during the POR. And in that opinion, you even discussed that Commerce only used a price inflator when it came to land because it didn't have contemporaneous data on the record. It has it here. And then to the second point, just quickly, again, going back to the surrogate country, Commerce defendant mentioned that there's nothing to measure economic comparability. That's not necessarily here, where the data has Mexico and Brazil. Commerce could have pulled that and treated it as a Tier 3 source, where we know that Commerce has already determined in the AD context, which is the same factual determination using GNI as in the CBD context, that Mexico and Brazil are economically comparable to China. So Your Honor is correct. The only leg they have to stand up on is that Thailand is geographically more proximate to China, which within itself does not constitute substantial evidence when compared to the other factors that are far more pressing, if you will.
Okay. That's it for those two issues.
Can I take one point?
Yeah, go ahead. Then he gets
sure.
to come back.
One important distinction between Tier 2 and Tier 3, if we're looking at the regulation, again, this is 351-551. Tier 2 requires this analysis of comparability, and in fact, Your Honor, in the third administrative review, remanded, I believe it was the averaging of the IHS and Comtrade mm-hmm. data, because Commerce didn't engage in this comparability analysis. So while that may be required under Tier 2, Tier 3 doesn't have that same requirement. That language isn't in the Tier 3 regulation. Commerce has much broader discretion in this under Tier 3, and the factors that it
shows. By the time you get to Tier 3, you're pretty desperate.
Well, I just want to note the distinction between Tier 2 and Tier 3.
Thank you. Do you want to say anything else about no, okay, he doesn't want to talk about the distinction between 2 and 3. Okay, do we want to talk about any other issues before we talk about EVA?
I'll just briefly say that we concur. We're happy to
You better come to the microphone
yeah,
before you talk.
We're happy to chat, but we concur with defendant's request for a voluntary mand on the issue of electricity, polysilicon, the aluminum benchmark, and we're prepared to rest on our briefs for aluminum specificity.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Sit down. Let me see. Okay. We're going to take a 10-minute. What we're going to do, folks, is this. I don't think anything public, I mean confidential, happened in this part of the record, correct?
That's correct.
So this argument will be posted. Anybody can understand what we're doing. Good luck to them. But it's helpful for me to have you here because I think I can understand the arguments better when I can see your faces and see what you look like when you're talking. And also, we had some papers exchanged. That was good. All right. The next part may have confidential information. When it's all over, I will ask you, did we talk about confidential information? And if you say yes, then we won't post it. Okay? So, but I want you 10 minutes before I have to deal with EVA, which is almost as vexing to me as EBCP, I wish a 10-minute break. All right.
All right.
Which way are we going? This is not my courtroom. That way? Okay.
Court stands in recess.